from Phoenix. Germán serves as the Vice President for Community Stabilization at Chicanos por la Casa in Phoenix. In his current capacity, Germán oversees the Neighborhood Stabilization Program 2 administration for CPLC's national consortium, consisting of 13 nonprofit organizations located across 8 states and the District of Columbia. Join me in welcoming Germán Reyes.
All right, good morning, everybody. So my name is Germán. As Susan mentioned, I'm very excited to be here. Actually, I'm quite humbled to be here in this convening. I'm often asked to talk, especially over these last 3 years, and I'll give you a little bit of background as to why. So I'm actually very humbled to be here to talk to you about what's going on in Phoenix. And I'm up here with a cane. I thought it was going to be cool because I've been on crutches for about 7 weeks because I tore my Achilles tendon. So my wife got me my cane because, you know, it's going to help me. And I thought it was going to make me look really cool, but both my kids at different times yesterday before I got on the plane said, "Hey, Dad, you look really old now, man." I'm like, "Oh." So what a bummer. But so I might have to sit down after a while. But by the way, I was playing basketball and I blew my Achilles. So let me tell you a little bit about who I am, and then Chicanos por la Causa. So some of you may know the term CPLC now, because it does stand for Chicanos por la Causa, and we're not your typical mom and pop nonprofit. You know, that's most people tend to think of nonprofits, and they'll think of the top two or three, and then typically, you know, they'll think of them as smaller, regional. We're based out of Phoenix, Arizona, and have approximately 750 employees, and this is after really some challenges over the last couple of years. So we've actually laid off, I'm not going to say a significant portion, but some folks. So understand we're about 700 strong in terms of employees. We do have, actually at some point, we as vice presidents got together and said, "Hey guys, we have to consolidate some of our lines of business." We had upwards of 30 lines of business that we've consolidated, but we now talk in terms of four pillars. So we offer social services, education, economic development. We do have a CDFI. I think a lady early on said, "Hey, stop saying so many acronyms, so stop me if you need me to explain some of these." But and then housing being the fourth. Typically, I may not necessarily follow the slides. I actually didn't even know I was going to attend until a week or so when I realized I could probably walk. So I kind of mixed and matched a bunch of slides. But the housing component that we've ran for so long, we've had a certified housing counseling agency for almost 30 years, which I think is really the cornerstone of what makes us very strong. And I'll talk a little bit about our performance and really keep that as kind of the lowest common denominator, if you will, for what makes us strong. Okay, so most of the CDCs that I represent for the Neighborhood Stabilization Program are a lot like us, not necessarily in terms of scope, but in that they're fabrics of their community, and I think that's why we've been successful. So let me see if I can. And we are headquartered in Phoenix, but we have started operations in Las Vegas, so we do have a housing counseling agency there, and in New Mexico. So let me move forward, because I know time is tight. So when it comes to NSP, I can talk. I mean, I hold conferences, and I actually hold 2 to 3 day conferences to talk specifically about the Neighborhood Stabilization Program. So the Community Stabilization Division that I now run started basically 3 to 4 years ago because of the award that we received from HUD. So we were one of the largest awardees, grantees for Neighborhood Stabilization in the second round. There were 3 total rounds. I think most of you guys know this, but if you don't, there were 3 total rounds. In the first round and the third round, only municipalities were awarded. So in the second round, they made it competitive and said, "All right, let's see which one of these a nonprofit or even for-profit investors can come in and give us a good, kind of a good proposal and, you know, whatnot," right? Well, they opened it up to nonprofits. We were awarded $137 million across, like was mentioned earlier, 8 states and the District of Columbia. And then we were asked as part of the network that we proposed as a network of predominantly Latino-based nonprofits. So it's the network that we belong to there is called NALCAB. It's the National Association for Latino Community Asset Builders. But we don't just cater to Latinos. I never want that to be the case. We cater to people, period. Okay, so we were asked to administer because of the basically of the breadth and strength that we have in terms of administration. And then I was asked to lead that consortium. So I can't see real well there. When I started the program, you know, when I started getting everybody together, I focused on three major themes, and they've held true basically over these last 4 years. One was results, and let me just tell you really quickly what HUD basically tells you. They give you $140 million, and you're all excited, saying, "Hey, man, this is really great, right?" And then they tell you, "No, by the way, in 24 months, you got to spend half of it, okay? And in 3 years, you got to spend it all, or else you wouldn't have met the requirement of the grant." And then you kind of think, "Well, hey, that's cool. That's a lot of money I got to spend. Hey, great, right?" But then they start putting a bunch of red tape, and you start to realize just how difficult it is. Not to mention the number one red tape is the fact that it's meant to be affordable housing. And then to make it worse, 25% of the entire expenditure has to be to 50% or less of the area median income households. So for me to sell a house to someone making 50% or less, it's a challenge. Okay, it's a real challenge. So getting the money out is a real challenge. So impact also, one of the things I wanted to focus on, I think it was mentioned, I'll really dovetail into a lot of discussion up here, was being able to measure the impact. And I haven't really started doing a lot of that because really the results are coming in now, right? We've just now passed the three-year mark where we hit our expenditure mark, and we're starting to see just the impact that we made in terms of getting this money out the door. And then the other one that I really focused on early on was jobs, because I keep saying me, but I mean, you know, I worked with a large team, and that was... It was very important to be able to demonstrate that jobs were extremely important as a result of the expenditure of the money in housing. Okay, because remember, we were going through a big unemployment. We still are, right? Big unemployment issue. So the fact that you could demonstrate that you create a lot of jobs in terms of rehab and whatnot was critical. Now, investors will tell you, yeah, we hired and all this, and that's great. But show me, right? So we show HUD. We have to. But we actually have done some impact studies and I'll try, again, I'm very limited on time, but I have studies that we've produced that are actually, you know, if you're ever interested, by all means, contact me. I will tell you that Chicanos por la Casa at one point, maybe a couple years ago, was Fannie Mae's number one non-public buyer. Okay, so we were a formidable force in terms of purchasing, and we were doing that before the big dogs came on, right? These guys that are buying the 100 and some odd, that's great, but we were there trying to buy when we were fighting the smaller investors. The smaller investors are still predominantly the ones that are there. So the first look, does anybody not know what the first look was? The first look is basically a process whereby nonprofits get the first look when an REO property comes out. We drove essentially that process when NSP came out because, again, the federal government gives you a bunch of money and says spend it. How can you spend it if you're competing against investors, right? Not only that, the federal government says you got to get a discount. So when you buy it, you better get at least a 1% discount. So why would Fannie Mae sell this property if an investor is going to give you 100% and I've got to take it down to 99%? So understand, we have to communicate extremely hard with Fannie, with Freddie, with HUD, NCST, who was formed to get property out to the nonprofits in order to get our money out the door. So the first look happened for that reason, and it continues to be a very important mechanism for us to get property out to our homeowner population, okay? Because the first look goes out to nonprofits, but then there's also a first look to just homeowners. Investors can't buy. And then on the 16th day, for the most part, depends on which first look you're looking at, the investors can play. So really the catch here is work with the nonprofits, if you can, to get property out to the homeowners, right? And I mean, I can give you guys a big story on that. But here's, and I'll keep moving forward real quickly because I made too many slides. Here's kind of the quick look of what I'm running. And understand that we received our grant in 2010. Okay, so the two-year, you know, that two-year 50% expenditure was in 2012. We met that very nicely in 2013. So this year was the three-year date. So let me tell you how we're doing, because I like to brag, but I'm really not doing it to brag. I really want folks to understand that who's Chicanos por la Causa and how did they do this, okay? And we have a lot of methodology and whatnot, procedure that I think is very good to go out and talk to folks around the country about how we did this. There were 633. So on those three rounds that I talked about, there were 633 grantees that received funds. Okay, we were one of the larger ones, as I mentioned, but there's some that got even more. Habitat got a ton. A lot of the states, remember, we're competing against states, so the state of Michigan, you might imagine why, right, received, you know, over $200 million. Here's where it stacked up as of like 2 weeks ago. Now, the federal government shut down, so this is a weekly report that they produce. So this is a little dated. So we're number two in the country in terms of grantees, and we've spent, actually that number's, we're at $192 million right now off that $137. So again, people are going to say, hey, how'd you guys do that? So you guys got $137, how'd you get to $190? Well, let me explain how. Because while I'm proud about that, about this, the fact that we can show the federal government that nonprofits can, in fact, provide affordable housing and do it in a very responsible way and whatnot, here's what I'm really proud of. So there's this thing called program income. The federal government calls it program income. Program income is basically approach, or really it's the terminology that we use to say, hey, here's how successful we've been in turning over some money. So if you give me a federal dollar and I buy a house and then I sell it, that revenue that comes back is called program income. So if you got program income, that means you've done something. You've sold a house, maybe you've, there's an expenditure, there's a recycling, if you will, okay? So we're number one in the nation and have been for quite a while. So we're about $55 million in program income. And we continue to, in fact, we've done so much of it that I'm trying to go back now and have a big talk with our consortium members to stop selling, because we still have original line of credit dollars in our, the 137 that we can't get to because we continue to generate so much of the program income. So anyhow, so this, though, is why I'm here, right? Because I think that it gives us the credibility to talk to folks and get head-to-head with investors and say, so, what makes you think that you can talk about selling property? We've been there, done it. This represents and will represent at the end of the day over 1,000 single-family homes. It's actually more like 2,500 total units of something. And by something, I mean we said we do multifamily. We're land banking across the country. We're going to do a lot of construction. But what's big right now is single family, right? So we're out there trying to do a bunch of turns. So I'm really proud of this, and I wanted to, again, I'm putting on my NSP2 hat. I know I wasn't here to talk about learning from Phoenix, but I'm trying to tell you that this is why I feel like, I'm able to stand up here and talk to you, okay? Phoenix happens to be, so Chicanos por la Causa is headquartered in Phoenix, and again, we administer nationally. But Chicanos por la Causa in Phoenix happened to get the largest piece of the 137. So we were awarded $32 million in Phoenix. And this is all by census tracts, by the way. Just because I show the state, you can't invest in the entire state. It's in specific census tracts, mostly high foreclosure tracts. And many, many of them, conversations that guys have, very highly minority-influenced areas, okay? It's very, very true when folks talk about that. Folks that are underground here, a lot of us, we know that Latinos and African Americans were disproportionately hit big time, okay, when it comes to fund, to loans and whatnot. And so where we're selling to is actually those areas, okay? So it's we keep talking about the challenges. I mean, we've been there, we're there doing it now, so we know just how much wealth has been stripped from these communities. So all right, so let me move forward. I'll pass that. So I think I talked a little bit about the impact. I started creating some impact stories, and just very quickly, in terms of what it means to have spent the NSP grant money in Arizona alone, you can see that we're predicting that we're doubling the effect of the dollar. So we're able to track it down and say, hey, look, direct impact or induced impact. Induced impact basically means, hey, look, you got to buy the lumber somewhere, right? So you go to Lowe's, you go to Home Depot and buy it, and that's induced positive effect for some of these other folks in that value chain. So very positive data that comes out, and it's great because you can go back to the feds and explain that this isn't just money that, it was a stimulus grant. We all know that, and it's supposed to stimulate economies, but, you want to be responsible with it, and this is the way that you come back to them and say, look, here's what really happened and the positive impact it's had on communities. So I put that last bullet on there because I'm often asked, kind of one question for the most part. I'm going to get the water out here. And that is, so why do you think you've been successful with NSP? And, I kind of said a few things here. Actually, it's because of me, but no, that's not true. The reason is because the nonprofit developers that we talk about, we're all nonprofit developers, the 13 nonprofits that were awarded. But every one of us have a certified housing counseling agency, okay? So somebody here mentioned Texas, Arizona is still the case. In Texas, in some of the areas in South Texas, like McAllen and Brownsville, we've got 1,000 people in our buyer pool, people that want to buy houses. And these are affordable you know, folks, right? These are folks that are 80% area median income. We can sell up to 120, but trust me, in Brownsville and McAllen, it's mainly poverty level people that you're selling, that you can't get houses to them. So that's a different story. I mean, we have to subsidize the heck out of those houses to get to them. The thing to do in areas like that is to build. I mean, one of the guys up here was exactly right. Construction is where it's at right now in some of these areas. In Phoenix, we have hundreds of people in our buyer pool. Okay, so when the feds give you money and say, hey, spend it, the great news was that we were already essentially doing that and had people in our pipeline. That's why we were able to get it out the door so quickly. So this Section 3, let me just mention what Section 3 is, because it's not a common term, but the federal government wanted us to really think about Section 3. Section 3 is really when you spend dollars, try and spend it in the communities where you're investing, right? So try and hire people from within the community. Anybody that's in public housing qualifies as a Section 3 worker, for example. So we hit that hard from day one. So when we did contracts and had construction contracts, we told the contractor, by the way, here's blank dollars for this, but you're going to hire from the community, and we're going to monitor you and all that good stuff, right? So we really went out of our way to show not only that we created jobs, but that we met the Section 3 criteria, meaning we hired from the community, because I wanted our dollars spent in the communities where they were meant to go. Okay, so, and I think that this is good information because I am going to say at the end of this conversation that I want to team up with investors. That's the move now. I haven't in the past. I've been approached many times by investors, especially over the last 4 years. Hey, you know, help us out. You know, we need some inventory, or whatnot, right? Because we can get inventory to them. But, and this is not, I'm not trying to be mean, but I wanted the wealth to stay in the community, and I didn't want it to go with the investor. Why would I want that? Plus, I need to get my money out the door first. Okay, so, but now it's the time to talk, because now I can go leverage what I've got left. You know, I've got $50 million left. I'd rather leverage it now with capital. Now let's go and see what we can do in some of these communities. And I'll work with you so that we can try and leave some more of this in the community, right? So now let me get to kind of why. So the learning from, so this might seem a little funky to some of you guys because it's hard to understand what we did originally, but understand that in some of these communities when we started in 2010, nobody else was investing anyhow, right? So you know, we'd look at houses. And let me tell you a story first. The first guy I hired to help run the Arizona program, I was running the Arizona program, then it got too big at national level, so I moved up national. So I tried to hire a guy, say, hey, okay, come with me. So we drove down a neighborhood in Phoenix, and I said, hey, so there's an REO right there, you know, so what do you think? He looked at me, goes, I don't want to live here. I said, man, you're not working for me. You know, it isn't about what you think, right? I mean, somebody does. So my motto has always been, you know, for the most part, you know, don't tell me why you can't buy it. You know, tell me why you should or why you can't. All right, because I didn't mind putting $50,000 in rehab, and that wasn't being excessive. It's what it needed. But by investing in that property, I mean, I can show you we affected positively the neighbor's mentality next door. Okay, and it took a couple, 2-3 years. But as you started seeing this investment, it really did help to stabilize the community. And then investors started popping in and saying, well, oh, wow, well, and I'll show you why. So now remember, the federal money is a subsidized program, which means that you can, in effect, lose it. We don't want to lose it, but you could, right? So what we were seeing early on was, for example, I'd pick up a $90,000 property. I'd put $30,000 in rehab. So roughly, I've got about $120,000 plus, you know, some other costs, but $120,000 of total development costs, that's what we call it, right? The house is only worth $100,000. Okay, but I did that. We did that, my consortium. So why did we do that? Well, it's not that I wanted to lose the $20,000. It's because that house needed it, and somebody would buy it. It's just that it needs rehab, right? So the money did what it was supposed to do, which was to stimulate the neighborhood. So early on, we saw a lot of that's called a development subsidy. We left a lot of that behind, and we had no choice. It's what we had to do. It's kind of what the program's meant to do. And then about a year or so ago, here's what started to happen. That same house, roughly, right? I'd pick it up at 90. I'm putting 30, so I've got 120. People are knocking at my door to buy because they know we're putting out a good quality product anyhow, but the house is appraising for at least that amount. So that's, we started seeing that, and this is when we were still competing with a small investor. We started seeing that early on in the curve, the fact that there's a significant profit margin to be made here. And the reason I say that is because, you know, if we're putting $30,000 in a house, an investor can come in and say, hey, look, we'll we'll do this and this and this, maybe only put 15, and oh, by the way, we'll buy it at $10,000 cheaper. They know that they can make a significant return on a flip on those kinds of properties because we have the data to prove it. So anyhow, so that's, and this is a lot more common now, by the way. We're leaving very little subsidy. In fact, we're doing it now only to get the homes sold as affordable. Because, you know, even though the house is worth 130, you've got areas where people can only afford 120. So we use our dollars to go ahead and use gap financing to bring the value of the property down. So we still leave dollars in to get the houses sold to people that are that qualify, number one. So understand, we have a rigorous underwriting process as well, right? So we don't, you know, we aren't just handing out property. You know, we still want very responsible people buying property. So let me take you guys through this. Now, I'm not an Atlanta person, okay? So I did as much, you know, research gathering as I could to try and compare markets, because what I want to do is try and compare Atlanta to Phoenix, because I've been told that we're very similar. Okay, now, here's the issue that I had. There's just a ton of data, and some data will tell you, you can almost get out of the data what you want to see out of it. You can kind of say, hey, maybe it's going this or it's going that way. Everybody can kind of tell you. Everybody has their own opinion. What I wanted to do is find data points that I could compare apples to apples with. Okay, so I almost, as long as the fundamental data is the same, I can do this. So I found, this is what I found. And actually, I'll ask you guys as the audience, most of you here being from Atlanta, because I can tell you my market in Phoenix, and I know from running NSP that no one can tell you about your backyard except you that live there. I mean, that's true, right? Because you got guys that come in, hey, well, you know, no one's going to buy your house for $100. Hey, you know, how do you know? You know, come talk to me. I'll show you one. So with that in mind, does this roughly represent, because I'm going to ask you guys, because this is what I used, and I think it was roughly right, because I did benchmark it against some other stuff, but it kind of shows the home price index for Atlanta, and I think that's roughly indicative of the value of the property as well. So, you know, it shows, obviously, this big run-up to 140,000 or whatever, and I put the specific area, so they call it, you know, Atlanta home price. Within that, there's a specific, because Atlanta's a pretty big place like Phoenix, right? Phoenix, problem with Phoenix, like in Atlanta, but not so much so, is that there's many, many submarkets. And there's some submarkets, for example, Phoenix, that have gone up 80%. Then there's some others that have gone up 5%. And then there's some others actually who are still depressed. So on average, it's 30%. So when someone says the Phoenix MSA, it's 30%. But if you're living in submarkets, you can come to me and say, hey, you know, I'm still depressed, or hey, we're going gangbusters, okay? So that's why I use this as a benchmark. Does that, I mean, John, I'll look at you, but does that look roughly like the Atlanta market, I mean, that I'll compare it to. So then I went and I took the data for Phoenix using the same data, so I kind of just pulled it out of this spreadsheet that I was able to do. So check out this was pretty cool, right? When I looked at this, I thought, wow, this does, I think, tell you, at least for Phoenix, it tells you what happened, right? Phoenix went through the roof when we had the housing boom. That's through the roof, right? And Atlanta did too, but look at Phoenix. So naturally, in any downturn, you're going to see some extreme depression in value. And then as you see it come down, obviously Phoenix really, really hit down hard. And then what I think is interesting is you see, like, in over these last 3-4 years, when I tell you that I've been really working on NSP, you see a lot of, like, little blips. Those blips are significant. You know, to us, what that means is when you see it on the upturn and the slope is going up, you know, you got guys that are putting contracts on your door when you're out there rehabbing it, and I have multiple offers. And then there's the dips where it comes down, and there's almost an unwillingness to purchase. And I can almost tell you, in Phoenix at least, what those are. You know, so for example, there's a lot of economics behind this. When interest rates started going up, guess what? People stopped giving us contracts because they got scared. Like, oh, man, I just missed out on the interest rate boom, right? The interest rates were 3.5. There was a whole lot of people buying. It started going up, and it really started getting depressed. And then it started picking up again because the investors were buying so much that the demand was there. So then you saw this blip coming up, and now it's kind of right now in Phoenix, and again, this may not be Atlanta, but I'll give you kind of my two cents on what's on where I think it's going. It's kind of like stagnant again. Okay, my listings, we put up listings now, and they're on the market longer. I haven't reduced pricing, so pricing is still fairly stable, but I'm going to have to reduce pricing pretty soon if I want to sell my property, because they're on the market longer. So, and I think that one's a little weird because of the federal issues, because my problem right now is that most of my loans are FHA backed, you know, so there's a whole lot of problems there. So you know what, I'm going to have to blow through this, but so I think that what I'm trying to say here is that I do see a trend, and it does seem to follow, Atlanta seems to follow Phoenix. And so real quickly, I I charted through columns, and looking at just the numbers, it seems to me that Atlanta is trailing Phoenix by about 10 to 12 months. So, and we talked about this yesterday, because one of the things that I did say is, if you were to ask me what would I do differently if it was 12 months ago in Phoenix, I would tell you that I'd buy everything I could. I'd buy everything I could. If you know your market, don't haggle over a few grand. I know it sounds kind of silly, but a few grand to me when your average market is 140 is minuscule when it goes up 10%. So I would be buying everything that I could. You know what? I've been told I got 3 minutes. I'm going to blow by some of this stuff real quick, and let me get to the good stuff. I actually had some relevant stuff. Okay, so let me tell you how I look at stuff, right? I'm all about area median income. Someone asked about your area. So look, I'm all about that. If you tell me what the area median income is, because every MSA has one, right, that's published, and you tell me what the median home price is, I'll tell you if you should buy, if you're an investor. I mean, I'm sure they do this. So, and someone asked about ratios. Okay, look, the ratio everybody uses is 30%. 30% of your gross income ought to be your maximum housing expense. And that goes for rental. Okay, so real quick example. Check out a family of four in Phoenix, and it's very similar to Atlanta. It's $60,000, okay? $60,700. So I use $60,000 just to cut it down at $5,000 a month. At a 30% housing expense, that's $1,500 a month that they can afford. I take out 20% or $300 really, because that's taxes, insurance, maybe HOA. So they can afford a mortgage and interest. Is that M? Should be P. Principal and interest payment of $1,200. So it doesn't take a lot of math to know that at 3.5% down, 30-year, 5.5%, these guys, you can afford $219,000 house for this specific MSA. Remember, there's a ton of submarkets, so just analyze your submarket. So if that was the case, in Phoenix, if I use that example, I actually glance right through it, and I'm saying that the home values right now are $192,000, I'd be buying until I know that I can feel very comfortable that I'm going to sell it at two, whatever, right? So now Atlanta, to me, was kind of weird, right? Atlanta, the data that I saw was 146. And if that's true, there's a ton of upside for certain areas. And that's why I keep saying, I mean, look at the area, I'd be buying all day long, because you're going to find out that based on who your average median income person is in that, I mean, let that dictate your buy for the sale of flipping. If you're an investor, I like to think in terms of selling to a homeowner. And then your exit strategy is always the rental. The $1,500 is also a rental stream. I mean, you also calculate affordable rents the same way. And so and that's what I said there. So, for example, I pulled this up from the HUD website. These are what are called the fair market rents. And hopefully that's exactly what you guys see in terms of Fulton County. I pulled up Fulton County. Here's Maricopa County. You see how four bedrooms, I mean, you can get $1,500 a month in Maricopa County. You can get, based on this, rough $1,400 for a four-bedroom. If you use the same kind of calculation I said before, I mean, investors can come in and buy, and even as an exit strategy, meaning they can't sell it, they can rent it for a fairly significant rate of return. So, if I was investors, and I do want to talk to investors, I'd be buying in certain markets. So, real quickly, so investment, is it good? I can't read that. So, investment is good, but the investors ought to think of the community when they invest. And a lot of them talk the talk. I'll just put up everything I have. You know, they'll say, hey, you know, yeah, we're interested in the community. But what I'd like to see is the wealth stay in the community if possible, okay? And I know that's a little hard to say, but that's what nonprofits typically do. I mean, the reason we're a nonprofit is you can't profit from something. So we leave, the capital gain, if you will, in the property as equity to a buyer. And I think there is a happy medium between, or actually a definitely a relationship that can be formed between capital investors and nonprofits. And, you know, someone put up a thing there saying, hey, they're not buying in distressed areas. Guess what? That's the perfect place to start, because that's where we live. I mean, I can show you how we can partner with capital, because you know what? The nonprofits can bring to bear other monies in those areas that actually hedge their bet. Okay, so, I mean, I have another, I'm running out of time, but, and then also the thing that we can do as nonprofits that will help investors is, remember I talked about this buyer pool? We have hundreds and hundreds, but a vast majority of them are being counseled, credit counseled, because they have a 520 FICO score. But you know what? These are really good people that have jobs. They've done blank. It's just that they have a little bit too much debt, and the car will get paid off and whatever. And you know what? They're going to be good to go in 24 months. Guess what? They're the perfect lease purchase tenant. We can put lease purchase people in the houses that they want to eventually sell, not necessarily rent. And I'd rather have home ownership. Me, personally, I always would rather have home ownership than rentership. So a lease option is always preferred over a rental scenario. Okay, so I'll just keep moving forward. And then I do want to say that I do agree with what this one gentleman said up here about new development, new construction. I definitely think that new construction is right now in Phoenix, it's where I want to focus. So I think in Atlanta, you know, what I would be looking at is land to purchase, because I think infill construction is going to be big at soon, because at some point there's no more supply. So really, really would venture to say that construction is going to be big. Okay, I think I talked mostly about this already. So anyhow, so I'll stop there. But thank you so much. Appreciate it.
I wish we had 3 hours longer, but I want to remind you all that Herman's slides are going to be available on our website, and I encourage you to review those slides, because I know he had to rush through them a little bit, and I think Herman is also going to be around and is available to answer questions that you didn't have an opportunity to ask. It is my pleasure now to introduce Sarah Toering, who will moderate the code enforcement discussion. Sarah is the General Counsel to the Center for Community Progress and is a fellow at the Project on Affordable Housing and Community Development at Emory School of Law. She's an expert in the areas of land banking, code enforcement, tax foreclosure reform, and other important issues related to neighborhood stabilization. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you. Thank you, Susan. Good morning. I am delighted to be here with you all today. In my role with the Center for Community Progress, which is a national nonprofit, I get to travel throughout the country to places like Flint, Michigan, and Detroit, and Philly, and D.C. Just got back from D.C. last night. But my main office is here in Atlanta, and Atlanta's home, so it's good to be home. Good morning. I'm also delighted to introduce you to our two panelists on our code enforcement panel this morning. First, right to my left, we have Ms. Daphne Talley. Daphne is the code enforcement chief with the City of Atlanta code enforcement program under the leadership of Major Davis. Daphne has 15 years of experience in code enforcement, on-the-ground field experience. I'm sure she got her start in Fulton County code enforcement. I'm sure she's got a lot of stories and has seen a lot of different properties in our community here in Atlanta. In Fulton County. She has a lot of experience in communities like Pittsburgh, English Avenue, Washington Park, Dixie Hills, and she now leads up the code enforcement program on some of the most troubled properties, the properties that are in the demo program, also known as the NREM program here in Atlanta. So thank you, Daphne, for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
I'm also delighted to introduce to you Mr. Michael Braverman, at the end of the table here. Michael, who also just landed from Baltimore a few hours ago, or maybe an hour ago. So glad you're here, Michael. Michael has more than 25 years of experience as a prosecutor, as director of Baltimore's Housing Code Enforcement Legal Section, and now as Deputy Commissioner for Housing. Michael's played a key role in crafting many of Baltimore's neighborhood revitalization strategies. As deputy commissioner, Michael's re-engineered cleaning and boarding operations, eliminating the cleaning and boarding backlog of 7,000 citywide properties service requests, reduced the average response times from 319 days to 5 for cleaning, and from 153 days to 5 for boarding. Has doubled outputs from 15,000 to 30,000 completed requests, and is now heading up one of Mayor Rawlings Blake's new programs, the Vacants to Values program. He's going to share more about that with us this morning. Grateful to Michael for coming to join us here, and to Mayor Rawlings Blake for her willingness to share his leadership with us this morning. So welcome, Michael.
Glad to be here.
Very briefly, before I turn it over to the experts, I just wanted to start by making sure we all have a little bit of background and some similar definitions. How many of you are familiar with code enforcement? What is code enforcement? Okay, about two-thirds. One comment that I have in my travels throughout the country, I'm often surprised by the fact that the neighborhood leaders that we work with and nonprofits often aren't aware that code enforcement can be a really powerful tool and partner in efforts to stabilize neighborhoods. It may also shock you to know that in some local governments outside of Georgia, community development departments and code enforcement departments don't always share information. They don't always exist in the same building, or they do, but don't necessarily know what the other is doing. So what is code enforcement? Just a couple of comments. I think code enforcement is about a few things. It's about law and bricks. We have housing and building codes in most local governments in the country. There are some places that haven't adopted housing and building codes, and that's a different problem. But we have codes on the books that regulate how folks who own property have to care for it responsibly. So this is mowing ordinances, or maybe the basketball net ordinances. But it's also ordinances dealing with things like vermin, one of my least favorite words in the English language, and ensuring that buildings are kept up to code so they're safe. So it's about laws, and it's about bricks, and it's about how we enforce those codes that are on the books. Is it fines? Are there criminal sanctions sometimes? Are there laws that allow us to enforce code violations on the property itself, which is some of what Daphne is going to talk about with the NREM program. Code enforcement, however, is also about people. So just briefly, code enforcement is about ensuring safety for neighborhood residents and also for first responders. You know, firefighters have very specific training that they go through for vacant and abandoned substandard parcels that's different from other kinds of property. So enforcing codes is about safety for people. And also about eliminating blight and supporting stable neighborhoods and thriving communities for the folks that live next door to the boarded up house or the house that isn't boarded up yet. So law, bricks, and also people. I think you'll hear about those things from both of our panelists this morning. So I want to turn it over to Daphne, who's going to share with us a little bit about Atlanta's code enforcement program, what's currently going on. Daphne.
Thank you, Sarah. It is my pleasure to be with you guys this morning to share with you on behalf of the City of Atlanta code enforcement section. More often than not, code enforcement is blamed for the appearance of communities because of the economy. How many of you agree with Sarah that code enforcement can benefit your community? Okay. How many of you agree that code enforcement is bad? That we are only after property owners for money? Good, okay. All right, well, the City of Atlanta Code Enforcement Section has been transforming for the past year and a half. In 2012, we went under the leadership of the Atlanta Police Department. And with that, and since that time, our staff has increased. We've increased actually by 50% since we actually went under the leadership of code enforcement, I'm sorry, of the City of Atlanta. We now have about 20 inspectors in the field. We have 3 supervisors, 3 senior people, and we also have a demolition team, which is actually the NREM program. That's the team that I manage. We also have an administrative staff, and we also have a research team that make every attempt to find these property owners for these abandoned properties. Our current caseload right now is about 3,100 open or active cases. That does not include the 800 cases that have been forwarded to the NREM program for some type of city abatement. We receive about, I would say, 25 cases per month where those violations are unsecured, abandoned, dilapidated structures. So with that, I want to tell you about some of the challenges that the City of Atlanta Code Enforcement Section face on trying to bring those property owners into court. One of our biggest challenges is locating the property owners. In 2011, we spent over $50,000 trying to serve citation to absentee landlords living outside of the City of Atlanta, outside of the state, and even outside of this country. Our research team, which I believe we have access to some of the more sophisticated research tools in the city, but they have a difficult time finding property owners, or I guess I should say investors. When investors are buying the properties and the name of the company is an LLC or an LLP. So we can find ABC LLC, but we cannot define a responsible officer to cite and bring into court to address those open and vacant violations. And the ones that we do come in contact with, the very few, they'll tell us, yeah, we purchased that property sight unseen. I saw it on the web, I saw a photograph of it, I paid $10,000 for it. So you're telling me that there's a hole, a gaping hole in the roof, that a tree has fallen onto the property, that the grass is 20 inches high. Well, I tell you what, the city can take over that property. The city can demolish it. So when that happens, those cases are transferred, again, to the NREM program. It costs the city, on average, $25,000 to demolish a property. That includes the required asbestos survey and an abatement and the demolition. So the funding is not enough. We realize that. Those 834 cases with the budget that we have to demolish will probably sit until someone come forward to either rehab or demolish themselves. That's our biggest challenge. Another one of our challenges is state law or processes that are in place. So let's say that we do have those resources to demolish all of these vacant, abandoned properties. What happens after they're demolished? You have a vacant lot. And what happens after that? You have overgrowth. So now the city becomes responsible. We're not the owner, but the communities say, well, you tore the house down, so now that you're responsible for maintaining that property. Again, there's not enough funding to do so. So that's another big challenge for the city of Atlanta. So we do have successes. Like I said, in 2012, we went under the leadership of the police department. Our staff did increase by 50%. We also have a relationship now with Public Works. Public Works, and this is something new, this just started in July, but Public Works is now cutting, or has committed to cutting those vacant lots that has gone through the NREM program. So they are now cutting those lots. We now have a better relationship with the Atlanta Police Department, officers. So what we have found is that the data, basically where crime is, this is generally in or around where vacant properties are located. This past year alone, I believe the Atlanta Police Department had service calls to 1,000 vacant properties. Another success that we've had was the support of the APD officer serving our citations. Like I said, we spent $50,000 in 2011 serving citations outside of the city of Atlanta. So we now have that connection with the APD officers in serving those code enforcement citations. The vacant property registration, effective April of 2012. Since then, we have about 2,020 properties that have been registered to date. And we've received over $200,000 in fees. Unfortunately, it doesn't come back to code enforcement. It goes into the general fund. But still, that has been a benefit for us today. And some of our top priorities, or I guess I should say one of our top priorities that we're working on right now, is moving to an administrative process. This will allow code enforcement to mail citations out as opposed to personal service. This will save money, and it will also give the community, those violators, time to appear in front of their peers as opposed to a criminal system. So we're kind of decriminalizing the code violation. And it's not the highly hazardous or the ones that pose a threat to the community. These are your trash and debris, your junk vehicles. So we are looking at doing that. Sir, mm-hmm. These are our biggest challenges and successes.
Thank you. Thank you, Daphne. Michael, tell us what's going on in Baltimore.
Good afternoon, everybody. Good morning. It's actually a pleasure to share the podium with Daphne, my colleagues in code enforcement in Atlanta. It's nice to be together again. We have sort of mutual challenges. I think I had 10 minutes, And I can definitely talk about code enforcement for hours. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to sort of pare that down to 10 relevant minutes. And rather than going, you know, at length what we're doing, you know, more in detail in Baltimore, just to say in general that we have spent a fair amount of time with similar challenges that we all face in the actual mechanics of the basic blocking and tackling of code enforcement to sort of build capacity. And we've built a fair amount of capacity over the years, and the question really becomes, I mean, how do you deploy it strategically? So where we are in Baltimore right now is, and we all have very different market situations, but to when you've built the capacity and you're able to deploy it strategically, you know, you need to do that. What we have learned is doing that in sort of a data-driven, market-based way can get us outcomes and allow us to be part of the community development community and get outcomes that code enforcement previously was sort of outside the loop of. And I think that's where you led, Sarah. How do we see code enforcement as sort of a community development tool? So, you know, we've done the sort of basic blocking and tackling to build our capacity to professionalize the workforce, to increase our productivity, to infuse our operations with automated workflow systems and other IT tools. And we don't have the same problems that Atlanta has, but we have what we have, I think, that we share, and what I wanted to speak to a little today, the nature of this gathering, is we also have a fair amount of investor activity in Baltimore City, not the same kind of institutional, large-scale investor activity that you're seeing here, but there are some things worth sharing about how we've approached that. In our communities in Baltimore, we kind of run the gamut of markets from very, very distressed to very, very stable, and with a fair amount of Baltimore being sort of in between. And what we've found is that, and I think one of the things this conference is bringing forward is that, you know, our investors, you know, have names and faces and business plans, you know, and we can sit down with them and talk about, you know, where their capital can lead to effective and appropriate community development in areas that's sustainable. And then we can use these code enforcement tools to ensure whole block outcomes. And Sarah sort of gave me too much credit by saying I'm leading the Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake's Vacants to Value program. I'm one of the many legs in this stool, basically managing sort of all aspects of our code enforcement operations. But where they fit into her program, which is about blight elimination in Baltimore and growing the city, you know, is there are actually in distressed areas, there are ways that code enforcement can work with capitalized investors to ensure whole block outcomes, areas that investors might not be interested in without that level of support, meaning using code enforcement tools to assure that every single property will either get rehabbed or forced out into commerce through code enforcement tools to be auctioned and purchased by qualified buyers. And in other markets that are relatively stable, making sure that all the cleaning and securing gets done, which is leaned on the property, and making sure the demolitions, the spot demolitions that need to be done, get done. And even in distressed areas, demolitions can leverage investment even there. Because we all are aware that the absolute capital dollar cost of these demos are really outside the realm of what certainly we have locally right now. How do we use what dollars we have as strategically as possible to stabilize communities, leverage investment, create green space? So we're actively sitting down and talking to our investors. We're actively sort of bringing them together with our nonprofit community and working on the presumption that, you know, if people are acquiring, investing in, rehabbing vacant buildings, either for first-rate rental or for home ownership, then they are part of the team that will lead to Baltimore's ongoing success. And so that narrative has been changing. I think when I first started, it was kind of a us and them sensibility. And I think, you know, we still have some of that, but now we're really moving towards a place where we recognize that our local investment community really knows where to place their dollars. I mean, those dollars are going in places where they see sustainable communities in the long run, and they're actually part of that revival of the market. They understand our markets well enough because it's their own dollars at stake. So we can work in tandem with our nonprofit community because some of our nonprofits are able to do fantastic sort of multifamily dwelling, multifamily approaches that can anchor and stabilize areas. And our investor community is basically focusing on single family dwelling for rental or rehab. So we've got some phenomenal successes around the city. It would take me a long time to talk about all of them. That's the general overview, and hopefully we can open it up to questions at some point.
Can you talk a little bit, Michael, about how you have sort of brought those folks to the table together? I mean, is this sort of a series of meetings, or, you know, a plan that's been in place that the city has led? Is this led by in the nonprofit community? How has that worked?
Well, I think, and this is probably, you know, sort of what's happening here today at the conference, but it's hard, you know, to not, you know, from our code enforcement perspective, we're on the street dealing with vacant buildings, mm-hmm. we're issuing the permits, you know, mm-hmm. we're getting yelled at for, you know, all of the various government processes that are impeding the free flow of capital into communities. Mm-hmm. It's all our fault, you know. Mm-hmm. So we get to meet everybody who's wagging their finger at us. And and at the same time, I think really it came out of the sort of the open approach that we have. We issue the violation notices. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that violation notice is an invitation to communicate. And our local investors have taken advantage of that, given us an earful. And we have, you know, we've been able to realize that, you know, our local investor community is really supplying a lot of capital. That's an enormous part of the solution. Mm-hmm. So I think it began with, you know, the interface between code enforcement and the property owners through our notices, et cetera. And I think, you know, in particular, as we became really good at cleaning and boarding, you know, and leaning the properties, we got a lot of complaints about, you know, how the liens that we were creating were impeding their activities. And we backed up. We said, well, we'd love to talk about it, but somebody's got to clean it, you know. So we're going to do it, and you're going to pay for it. But maybe we can work out a way that we can communicate a lot better. And I think that was sort of the beginning of a discussion. And now I think I would characterize our local investment community as full-on partners in the revitalization of Baltimore. It's both distressed, and we have middle-market neighborhoods that are pockmarked with vacants. And our investor community sits down at the table with us as we devise strategies so that we can get those properties out into the market as quickly as possible. And so I think we have a very clear common interests.
Mm-hmm. Any comments about the? Oh, excuse me. Do you have a comment, Daphne? Okay. Any comments about the differentiate? I've heard you say local investment community, and Daphne talked about the difficulties of finding absentee investors. So in my head, these are the folks, you know, on their computer screen somewhere in Florida buying property in Detroit in the middle of the night. You know, how do you interact with that part of the investment community, if at all? Any advice?
Well, for us, I mean, we're doing the same thing. We're trying to make contact as much as possible, sending out notices, trying to work with the investors. Unfortunately for us, so many of them are out of state. And the few that we do come in contact with, there has been some resolve, but a lot, like I said, most will say, we bought it sight unseen, mm-hmm. And we're not interested in the property. Take it, mm-hmm. demolish it, clean and close it, do what you have to do. So that's where we are as City of Atlanta Code Enforcement.
Just a couple of comments. We're going to turn to questions here shortly. So if you have questions, please make your way to the microphones, and we'll turn to that shortly. Just briefly, throughout the country, increasingly code enforcement departments are turning away from criminal sanctions. in part because of the difficulties and the expense of service. When a violation is criminal, there's certain standards of service. You got to serve this, you know, this is personal service like you see on TV. It's very expensive. Mailing notices, you know, our goal in code enforcement is compliance. We don't necessarily want to put a bunch of folks in jail. We want the property, the blight to be removed. Mm-hmm. So moving away from criminal sanctions and focusing instead on the property. Another unique sort of legal tool that's been used increasingly throughout the country is ensuring that code liens, code violation fines, are given the same priority as taxes. We call it super priority lien status, and that possibility is available in Georgia. Some communities have used it. I don't know if you have any comment about that program, Daphne.
Right, and actually we call it the judicial interim process. And I would say in the past 3 years, we've taken only about 4 cases through that process because that process is lengthy. And the solicitor's office currently does not have the manpower or the staff to take it through that particular process. So we have been taking the majority of our cases through the administrative interim process, but that's one of our hot topics or our top priorities is to make judicial interim a priority.
Okay. Questions?
Comment and a question.
Could you introduce yourself? Do you say your name,
I'm
please?
I'm sorry, my name is Aurelia Chapman. I'm with the Village Community Development Corporation. I'm also an associate broker, real estate broker.
Thank you.
But one of my comments was earlier we heard that there is a shortage, there's expected to soon be a shortage of inventory, when I disagree with that we have a lot of inventory. There's a shortage of affordable housing. And a lot of people have nowhere to go, and ultimately when you have a vacant property, that's what's going to attract the crime and the people making the best use of a vacant property. So, and it sounds like the properties in Atlanta, in a lot of cases, you wait until the property is in such disrepair that you ultimately have to demolish it. And I would like for the city to start, like you said, through that judicial process to try to streamline that, where they can transfer some of these properties maybe to a nonprofit organization or a nonprofit for-profit partnership to rehab these properties, to put families in them that can afford these houses. Because when people have nowhere to go, they're going to find these properties and they're going to get in them and they're going to access it, and you really can't control what goes on at that point. Mm-hmm. So, and it just sounds like too many properties, they wait until it's so long down the line that the properties fall in such disrepair that the only option is to demolish it.
Right. And that's not the case all the time. Generally, when the city demolishes that property is already in disrepair. Now, we clean and close actually more properties than we demolish. And as I mentioned, state law and processes make it difficult for the city after we demolish or clean and close, I guess, in this case, clean and close a property, it makes it difficult for us to transform that property. Meaning take ownership of it. Actually, there is a meeting after, I believe some representatives from Atlanta are meeting after the conference to determine or figure out how can the city now start foreclosing on some of these liens that we have so that we can either donate it back to the community to make it a functional lot or a functional property.
Hi, my name is Rachel Scott. I actually kind of have a follow-up to what you were just discussing. Michael talked about the project in Baltimore of working with investors to either get them to develop or get that property back out into the market. And Daphne, you talked about some of the challenges in being able to get those properties back out into the market so that nonprofits or other homeowners could develop them. I would be interested if you could talk very briefly about what the legal process is in Baltimore that makes it easier for you to get those properties back out into the market, and from Daphne, what we need to see in Georgia in terms of the legal process that needs to change to make that easier.
Okay. Sure, and I and Daphne, you could say I'm sure everything here is in motion, right?
Yes.
Moving towards
yes.
more fluid systems. So the short answer to your question would be we have a local receivership ordinance, and that name means a lot of different things to different people, but the short version of receivership in Baltimore is if the building is vacant, it is a per se vacant and unsafe, it's per se a nuisance, we can then we would definitely go to the district court. We can ask the district court to appoint a third-party receiver for the purpose of auctioning the property to a pre-qualified bidder. And so that way we can actually push the property that's owned by somebody who's not going to take care of it for many different reasons. I mean, Baltimore's lost 350,000 people over the past 50 years. So we have a phenomenal amount of properties that are titled to deceased individuals, not necessarily driven by foreclosure or something like that. It's just literally vast neighborhoods are depopulated. Those are the least likely to see reinvestment like we're talking about, but there are still areas of investor activity around nodes of strength where we would do that, and then in our middle markets. And so we use this receivership tool, and that works pretty promptly, conveys good title, doesn't matter what the secured debt is on the property, it just convey the property with good title, and title insurers will write title insurance. And that's one way many of our investors get property that otherwise they couldn't get, or nonprofits bid just as frequently on them as well.
And Michael is correct. The city of Atlanta, everything is in motion. From what I understand, we are about 10 months behind that goal, but that is something that we need to address, because we have several vacant lots in the city of Atlanta, be it through demolition by the city, by private owners, or just undeveloped lots that needs to become functional lots.
Just a quick comment on that. You know, Georgia does not have, no community in Georgia that I'm aware of has the same kind of receivership tool that is available in Baltimore, although it's a very powerful, excellent tool. But just to brainstorm one possibility, I don't know if Chris Norman is here, but here in Atlanta we have the Atlanta Land Bank. And some of the work that Mr. Norman is doing there, I think, is an excellent example of the types of partnerships we've been talking about this morning with local government, nonprofit, and private investment. In Atlanta, where we have situations where there's a property vacant, abandoned, where, for example, the taxes owed, back taxes, are more than the fair market value of the property itself. That is a property that we refer to sort of as dead, in the sense that nobody in the private market is going to come in and buy that property. If the back tax is owed or $20,000, the property is worth five. Or we have these situations where property is worth less than zero because it really needs to be taken down, and we know it's 25 grand to demolish a property. In that situation, the city of Valdosta has done in that situation, in Valdosta, they have this super priority code lien ordinance where code liens, violations on these junk, dead properties, are more than fair market value itself, and they're first in line. The local government, Valdosta, can do a tax foreclosure on that property and transfer the property immediately to the Valdosta Land Bank. And then Valdosta Land Bank can transfer the property to Habitat for a dollar. And so Habitat, at least, is not having to try to come up with $20,000 in back taxes for a property that's worth less than zero. So there are some creative legal tools here in Georgia that we can use, and Atlanta has access to some of them, and there's some really great leadership here in the city and throughout the state that's using some of those tools.
Hi, my name is Alan Wang. I'm a part-time housing counselor at Center for Pan-Asian Community Services. I also work with real estate investors from around the world in Asia and Europe. And we do business with some of the hedge funds. I think this is a moving conversation, and some of the questions that I have has been asked already. And it seems to me right now, currently, there's no answer to property owner that may have contacted DAFI and said, hey, take it over. So there's currently not a process for you to just receive that property from maybe an international investor. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, I really like what you just mentioned about Valdosta and giving it to Habitat for Humanity. I was just going to mention perhaps there are families that are in need of housing. We could do that. And I was trying to maybe ask for collaboration between hedge funds that, you know, maybe we work with or that are represented here. Now, they may be doing some corporate charity in terms of donating the funds to actually build that property. Mm-hmm. And that's truly a collaboration between all. And I think that's something that needs to be developed as soon as possible. And I do see there's, from my point of view, I see a shortage of housing because I do housing purchase seminars. I constantly see students telling me that they can't get a house because it's being purchased through cash. And right now, currently, according to the Georgia Builders Foundation, it costs $80 per square foot to build a property. And I had mentioned to several the guest panelists, maybe they can consider releasing 1 to 3% of your portfolio houses onto the market, and perhaps they'll solve the inventory shortage. But I'm really glad to be here and just to be amongst all the minds that truly care for the community. And I love the fact that there's private sectors investing in our neighborhood, unlike Wall Street, because they're just creating a book entry for that loan. And lots of times we found cases where you could not find that lenders actually provided money for that. It's just like a credit card. You create money out of thin air because you want to borrow it. They put a book entry, and that's it. They don't do the maintenance. They don't do any support. So I'm really glad to be here, and I'm glad to be amongst this audience. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Judy Walker. I'm a resident in Oakland City. And when you say there's a lack of housing, I want to tell you there's a surplus of housing in Oakland City, or the 30310. And someone told me yesterday through some statistics of Nexus, only 10% of the housing stock there is owner occupied. Almost 40% is vacant and abandoned. And we have numerous times the neighborhood organizations, the MPU, have given lists of the housing code violations to the city. You know, we saw some houses being placarded, but I can't tell you there's an unlimited amount of vacant, open homes that, you know, are high crime risk. And it's like, what is the priority of the city with addressing those concerns? And we try to attract homeowners and even renters often. They look the other way because of the housing plight. And there are so many other pluses with accessibility to MARTA, transportation, the airport downtown. But when you look at the city, housing code is broken when it comes to in that community. I don't know how you prioritize, and I do understand that there's some legislative issues, and the legislative branch definitely needs to be addressed both judicially and with maybe the elected officials making some ordinance changes to address that. But, you know, they are, and it's been ongoing. It's not anything that just happened over the last year or two. You know, we're looking at 5 or 6 years, and it's, you know, what do we do to start turning that around in the community to make it safe? You know, it increases the opportunity for violence, gang violence, you name it on down the list. And when we try to work to invite investors to the community, they turn the other way.
Right. And I agree with you. Our first priority, though, is to attempt to get the owner to comply that property. Because as I mentioned, there's limited funding. Right now, there are over 200 in demolition orders that we have on the books, and no funding to address either one of those demolitions or those properties. And that's why today and moving forward, we're trying to put, you know, legislation in place that will allow the city to either take ownership, donate it back over to the community, or put families in those properties. Also, we're looking at, once again, working with Public Works to secure those properties. Right now, they're cutting the grass, but we also want to work with Public Works as opposed to getting an outside contractor that's going to charge us $10,000 to secure that property. We want Public Works to go to Home Depot and get some plywood and secure those properties to take away that threat from the community. But right now, in order for us to address those, we're addressing them or prioritizing them in the order of which they came. We're also looking at the severity of the property. We're also looking at the location of that property. Is there a school nearby? So that's how we're prioritizing with the limited funding that we have today.
I'm Janie Mills. I live in the zip code 30310 in that Dare Park neighborhood. My question, as it happens, not knowing the previous question, deals with the vacant property registration list. I want to know how it's working, what is being done about those which have not been listed, are fines being levied, is the list being of an assistance to code enforcement?
Okay. Again, it was adopted in April of 2012, and as of today, we have 2,020 properties that have been registered. It has benefited us greatly because a lot of those properties that were registered were actually on our demolition list. We were able to take those off the list and issue notices or citations to those property owners. So we are assessing fees, of course, that are associated with registering the property, but right now we're not actively enforcing the code, meaning we're not going after these property owners in assessing fines. Just of yet, just because of staffing issues, what we're doing, when we receive a code violation for that property, we do put the information in the mail. We let them know that this is a requirement today. But because of staffing issues, we're not able to go out and issue citations for that code violation. But the ones that we encounter, the ones that are responding to notices on these vacant properties, have registered those properties.
Thank you. We've got time for one more question. Councilwoman,
if you have a question. Hi, I'm Councilmember Joyce Shepherd, City of Atlanta. And you know, I'd just like to say I'm glad y'all are having this forum today. This is great. I came because I wanted to listen and learn anything else. I've been to Baltimore. As a matter of fact, I took a delegation to Baltimore. We created a relationship and looking at best practices across the country in terms of what's best. And we're doing a lot of things in terms of excellent. In the next year, we're going to be rolling out some of the examples of Baltimore. We're going to call it a different name, not vacant to value.
Yes.
But property registration is also legislation that I actually created. I worked on it for about 3, 4, or 5 years before we could get it done because it had to, the state laws have to change in terms of property registration. When you talk about property registration, it's done in other cities, but in the state of Georgia, and we talk about the city of Atlanta a lot, I just want to say to you all that we really need to be talking to our state legislators also. This is an issue that's really not, and in Atlanta's an urban city, but when you go into rural areas, it's different. How we finally got property registration was when actually the recession hit, and then all the rural areas began to see the same issues that we were having in our urban cities. That's when they wanted to do property registration. For 3, 4, 5 years from the time I came in office, I was trying to get property registration. My whole goal is to clean up our communities. And that didn't happen until other cities outside of Metro Atlanta began to see the problem that we had here in this city. So a lot of the issues we're talking about is also state. We talk about Baltimore, state laws versus Atlanta, Georgia laws. So when we're looking at this in terms of our residents, we need to understand that they just, as Daphne said, they just say, y'all are not getting anything done. It's much more complicated than what you assumed it would be. Even in terms of actually some of these folks having rights, and we have to go through that whole process. But as legislators, we're working as hard as we can to make that happen. We are looking at receivership. I just wrote down the information about Valdosta, Georgia. That was something new to me. I don't mind taking something for somebody else and making it happen in the city of Atlanta. Have no problem with that at all. I'll steal it in a minute. but to that point, the other issue is when we talk about our taxes, let's talk about right now in terms of some of these communities, 30310, where the taxes, if you look at your tax bill, I just got mine, so you might just get their tax bills in Atlanta. I've had some residents say to me that their tax bill is now $25 for the whole year. And they're saying, Councilmember Shepherd, I'm about ready to send them a check, $100 or $200 more, because can you imagine what happens in terms of that? So when we talk about our tax dollars, and by the way, that $25 that that resident told me, it doesn't just go to the city of Atlanta, by the way. It goes to Atlanta Public School System for Fulton County and then to the city of Atlanta. And so that's really crazy. So when we talk about even in terms of code violation in housing, we're also talking about our tax dollars at work and code enforcement. But we have to have money to make this happen. And I'm not trying to make any excuses, but that's a reality in terms of where our taxes are. We do an assessment, again, property registration, over 2,000. How many did you say were registered?
2,020.
That's great, yeah. But that's not enough. We know it's not enough. I was in Pittsburgh community yesterday with LaShawn tearing down the house that had been like that for 15 years, and we had to scrape up the money from somewhere that I can't even tell you where we got the money from just to make it happen. So we, and the money that we have is running out. But one of the things we are doing is, I'm one of these council members, I do look at best practices, it's why I'm here. I'm always trying to figure out what happens where. Public Works, we are looking at the possibility of turning Public Works into an entity that would tear down our houses, as opposed to right now we have contractors to do it. We've done an assessment to determine that it would be more cost efficient for us to have this in-house and having a crew that would go out every day and tear down houses and close and clean these houses. But I would tell you, my citizens, we need support from you all. I'm here as a council person fighting for all of that, but you've got to talk to the mayor, you've got to talk to your other council members, and you have to talk to the state. But this is an issue that is tough, is hard, and I just want you all to know we're working to do everything we can to make a difference. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilwoman. Okay. Last comment, ma'am, and then we'll have to close up.
I'll be real brief. Drenell Thomas with the Historic Weston Heights Bankhead Neighborhood Association. And that association was created because of the blight and the lack of support, as I feel it, from the community. But let's go back to 1996 when we started with the taxes and tax liens, when it may have been easier to work with people who own the property, who live there, but they lost the properties because of the tax liens on the property. And now everything is out of hand. And I'm really in favor of a strong America, so that if one neighborhood ails itself, then the whole city, the whole nation suffers as a result of that. So, and I didn't get up here to make a speech, but I just don't have the words to tell us what we need to do. Now, I grew up in the projects in Valdosta, Georgia, and there have been challenges there. I have lived in Atlanta for over 40 years, and there are challenges here. And we have got to make sure that people have places to live, the ones that don't have income. So someone said earlier that it's a whole social structure, and it's not just about money, but it's about how we reclaim our neighborhoods. And looking at the American dollar and where it flows in the world, we need to make sure that we are making wise decisions. Sorry about preaching, but we've got to find a way to find those owners by collaborating with other cities and other places across the nation where the owners are hiding.
Thank you. I want to thank our panelists, Michael, Daphne. Thank you so much for your time, for your expertise, for your leadership. Quick resources, check out the Baltimore Code Enforcement website. Check out the Atlanta City Code Enforcement website. There's a lot of great resources there. Also, the Center for Community Progress, centerforcommunityprogress.net. We have all kinds of resources available there on all of this nerdy stuff, tax foreclosure, code enforcement, these sort of weird tools that can be used to help eliminate blight and hopefully to help stabilize communities. Thank you.